So because there was a weekend, I would like to recapitulate what we have done to start with. So we started discussing the microscopic theory of phase transitions. So microscopic theory of phase transitions. And so as a model, the simplest possible example you can think of, we started using the Ising model. So Ising. And so the Hamiltonian here is just given, it's a model of ferromagnetism. It's a classical model. And the Hamiltonian is given by minus 1/2 sum over I and j. And there's this possible interactions, jij, and the spins in the lattice are denoted by sigma I, sigma j, and these take values, discrete values, plus minus 1. And so in general, you have a d-dimensional, so d-dimensional lattice, and then you denote by sides I, and then different side will be j, and so on. And the lattice is cubic lattice, is the simplest possible lattice you can think of in d dimensions. And so what I've done in the lecture, and which was maybe a little bit confusing when you did your exact calculation in tutorial later on, is that I was trying to solve this model by using the mean field theory approximation. Mean field theory approximation. So what you are interested in is the average magnetization, so magnetization M is the average value of the spin. And so we also discussed that the phase transitions are sort of a consequence of ordering. So, and for that, you always have to identify an order parameter. So in our case, it's precisely M is what you call the order parameter, how much the spins are ordered in your lattice order parameter. And so the main idea of the mean field theory approximation was to say, well, if I introduce a quantity epsilon, which will be sigma I minus M, which is a fluctuation of each spin with respect to this average magnetization, then you treat this as a small parameter. And if you do that, meaning you basically keep only, well, you neglect terms of the order of epsilon square, then you can show that this Hamiltonian rewrites in a simplified form. And so the Hamiltonian now looks like it's minus mj sum over sigma I, and then plus mj m square. So in the mean field theory approximation, you get a simplified Hamiltonian. And so if you look at that Hamiltonian, it's much, much simpler, because here we always had like two body interactions, whereas here each spin just interacts with this mean field M. So interaction of spins is average mean field M, and hence the name of the approximation. So yeah, mean field theory approximation, you replace all multibody interactions with just an interaction with external field, which in our case is a constant, and so each spin only interacts with the other spin through this M. Okay, so that's the idea of mean field theory. And so what we've shown also in the last lecture that consequently, if you have this Hamiltonian H, and then you switch on the statistical physics machinery, and you calculate what the partition function is, you calculate what the free energy is, then what do you find? That the free energy per site, so F over N is number of sites, is just given by Jm square over 2 minus t logarithm of 2 cosine h mj over t. So this is what we found last time. And so once, so this is your free energy, it depends on this m, on this magnetization, and of course this m will depend on t. So this is some complicated function of t in some sense. And so in order to find the actual configuration, if you want, then you minimize this free energy. So minimize F with respect to your magnetization, and that actually gives you the equilibrium configuration. And so the minimization, just take a derivative with respect to M, set it equal to 0, and what you find is this beautiful formula, tan H mj over t. So this was the formula for the magnetization, and of course you can plot it. It's an implicit formula which tells you how M depends on t. And if you plot it, you get this beautiful picture. So you have M here, and there is a t critical, which is equal to j. And so for t smaller than t critical, you have this non-trivial magnetization. And for t bigger than t critical, it's identically equal to 0. So now, of course, if you plug it back to your free energy, so now this is your dependence, how m depends on t, and I plug it back here, it's obvious that because m is non-analytic in t, so will be f. Okay, so f is non-analytic function of t because m is, and so whenever you have non-analyticity in your free energy or in your partition function or whatever, then you have a phase transition. Okay, so this is how you recognize that in the system you may have a phase transition, is that your free energy or your partition function is non-analytic function of temperature and other variables. Okay, so this is how you recognize that. Since m was the order parameter, and since during the phase transition, which happens exactly at this t critical, the order parameter is continuous, you call this phase transition continuous phase transition. If it were discontinuous, if it had a finite jump, so it would look like, for example, like this, and then it was a finite jump, and then zero, then it would be first order phase transition. So now, notice also one fact that nowhere in the calculation which we did last time and which I'm just repeating here, the dimension d really entered the stage. So this prediction here of the phase transition is actually dimension independent. Okay, so this is independent prediction of the mean field theory of dimension d. And so this may be very puzzling because in your tutorial and your homework, you've actually calculated what the free energy for the Ising model, at least in the nearest neighbor interaction, is exactly. And there you found that the free energy actually is analytic function of temperature. which of course contradicts this result. So compare to exact 1D Ising model, which you calculated, and there you calculated that the free energy is minus T, and then logarithm 2 cosine H J over T. And so now if you look at this thing here, then all of these things are sort of analytic. So this is analytic behavior. So no phase transition. So this is an exact result, so it must be true. So indeed, there is no phase transition present for one-dimensional Ising model. And that simply means that your mean field theory approximation in 1D is screwed up. And the reason I tried to explain in tutorial, but not everybody could hear that, so let me just repeat that. So in 1D, this is your spin which you are describing, and in 1D you have only a line of spins, and so if you consider the nearest neighbor interaction, then your spin is interacting with this guy and with this guy, but you are describing that interaction only through average mean field M, which is constant over all. So now of course if I start flipping these spins, if I flip this one here, the effective interaction on this guy should change drastically, right? Because the average field there will be different than if the spin is down. So if you know there is flip, and there is a problem. So epsilon actually in this case, so epsilon, which was my fluctuation, which was the sigma I minus M, cannot be treated as small, because you have only two neighbors and they have big effect on your guy in the middle. So epsilon cannot be treated small, basically. And mean field theory breaks down. Okay, so now situation is slightly better in 2D, where you have more neighbors. So in 2D, this is the spin I want to describe, but now I have not only this guy neighbors, but also I have the neighbors in other direction. So now I have four neighbors instead of two. And so if one flips, then of course the average value here of the field still changes, but it doesn't change that drastically as if it did when you flip one thing here. So here the fluctuations are still big, but a little bit less important and in some sense, you can say that your mean field theory will be more exact. So mean field theory, approximation is more exact. So now if you go to three dimensions, it will be even more exact. In fact, the Ising model in 2D already has phase transition, and that phase transition is sort of what we described here. So in 2D, your mean field theory is almost fine. In 3D, it's even better because you have even more neighbors and the fluctuations are even less important. And in D equal to 4, a miracle happens and your mean field theory is exact. So D equal to 4, it's called upper critical dimension. And the mean field theory is exact. Okay, so this is how you connect whatever you've done in your tutorial and homework, how, you know, to what I have done in the lecture using this mean field theory approximation. Questions so far? So finally, what we started doing is that we started studying the vicinity of the critical point, and I told you that various physical quantities. Yep.
In which range of temperature?
Well, okay. So what I'm really concentrating here on is the vicinity of the critical point, where, you know, strange thing happens. If you are outside of critical point, then the fluctuations really don't matter, and the mean field theory is fine. And, you know, as long as you are away from the critical temperature, mean field theory is fine. If you are close to the critical point, the fluctuations do matter. And then it depends on, you know, dimensions, how many dimensions you are at, and so on, whether this is fine or not. Yeah, but yeah. Okay, so the vicinity of the critical point, is described by critical exponents. And so last time, I basically talked only about one critical exponent. This was the critical exponent beta. And so the calculation, how it went. So again, so what is a critical point? So this is my M. This is my T. This is my TC. So we are concentrating on the vicinity here of the critical point. And so what I've shown you is that for this, you can think about M to be rather small, and so you can expand your free energy in small M. So you take that exact expression for F, and you treat M small, and then you do Taylor series of F. And what we found last time is that taking three terms was TC square over 2T, and that was this parameter small t, m square, and then plus tc4, 12, t cube. Sorry?
What was c again?
TC? So TC, that's, we found that, yeah, I'm sorry. So TC is equal to j, so it's, yeah.
First, TC is not squared anymore.
So, okay, so TC square over 2T, and then this small t parameter we define to be T minus TC over TC. Okay, so we found that the behavior of the free energy is something times M square, and then something else times M to the 4. So, and that the first something depended on the, you know, on the difference between T and TC. So there's this reduced temperature, small t, T minus TC over TC. Of course, this will be bigger or smaller than zero, depending on whether you are above critical point or below critical point. So basically, what is really important, as we shall see in today's tutorial and a little bit later on in this lecture, is that this coefficient, which stands by M square, can change sign, depending on whether you are above or below critical temperature. And then this coefficient here, if you call it B, is always positive. So that's what really matters. Okay, but before we get to that, so using this free energy, repeating the calculation which we done last time, you will find that the magnetization is something like 3, 1 minus T over TC, square root of that, or using the small t parameter, it's equal to minus t on beta, where beta is called critical exponent for the order parameter, for order parameter And we, so now, of course, reading from here, you find that beta is equal to 1/2. And that's your prediction of mean field theory. Questions? OK, so this is what you have done last time. I just told you the story once more. So now let us calculate other critical exponents which characterize our phase transition. So now other critical exponents. And so first one, the coefficient gamma, the critical exponent gamma, is related to susceptibility. Okay, so let us define susceptibility. So I'll do it in a simple way. So it's just denoted by chi is how the magnetization responds to the external magnetic field. Okay, so that's susceptibility. Of course, if you have taken some courses on electrodynamics or whatever, you will learn that susceptibility, in fact, is a tensor. So you can have different polarizations. So in general, you would have dmi over dbj, and chi would be a tensor. But let's treat it as a scalar, which lives on the diagonal of our tensor. And so this is the simplest thing you can have. And this is taken at t equal to constant. So at constant temperature. And basically what it describes is, you know, how does your substance, how does your system respond to the external magnetic field? Yes?
Do you mean that it's in general a tensor, which here is the scalar multiplied by identity?
Delta ij, yeah. Or is that correct here? Maybe that's not correct. So in general, it's a tensor. I treat it as a scalar. But
aren't there certain symmetries which will?
Yeah. I'm just applying magnetic field in one direction, so maybe the other components are just zero. I think. Yeah, you would have to check that. So anyway, so what it really describes is whether the material is attracted to or repelled from the magnetic field. If you have magnetic field, what happens with your material? So now, in order to describe this quantity, you basically have to redo your calculation as we have done it here, but now add to your Hamiltonian the interaction with the external magnetic field. So you are just adding a term to the full Ising model minus b sum over sigma I. And so then if you do this mean field theory approximation, the same thing will happen. So you'll just take minus b sigma I there. So your Hamiltonian now in the mean field theory approximation just looks minus b and then whatever I had before, mj, and then sigma I, and then plus 1/2 nj m square. So this is how you edit interaction with your external magnetic field. And then, of course, the calculation goes exactly the same way as we have done here. So there's no surprise that wherever I see in the result mj, I have to replace it by b plus mj. So this was my old mj here. That thing is just a constant. It doesn't really play any role. But whenever I see in the result mj, I just replace it with b plus mj. So in other words, the free energy is given here, where I have now cosine h and then mj plus b over t. And this relation will become m is equal to tangens h, mj plus b over t. So just do it yourself if you don't believe this. So now, of course, if you apply the magnetic field, so this was your picture for the magnetization if b was equal to 0. So now, and there was a phase transition here. And really, there was a transition from M non-zero to M equal to zero. If you put magnetic external magnetic field, now of course it's preferable for more spins to be aligned in such a way that the energy is minimized for your system. Okay, so you still have fluctuations, but in much higher temperatures, still it's energetically favorable for, you know, more spins to align with the field than not. So your picture basically changes. And now you don't really have a phase transition. Instead, you have something like, you know, and this is small here. So you sort of lose this critical point in the external field. So this is B is non-zero. But you lose that critical point. So you cannot have a critical point when you have non-trivial external magnetic field.
In reality, though, like, things are never like zero, and if this is like a sensitive symmetry breaking situation, doesn't that mean that like even the slightest difference from B equals zero would cause like a very reliable
Well, okay. So in the end, yeah. So if you are sending B to zero, then you are returning back to that picture here. So in reality, yes, you are close to that picture over there when you send B equal to zero. But if I have, you know, finite B, this is what happens.
But isn't the symmetry breaking process like really, really sensitive to small, you know?
Well, in some, yeah. Yeah. So what we will be actually calculating now is, you know, what really happens when you have these small fields? How would you still characterize the vicinity of this critical point when there's this fluctuating or small external magnetic field? Yeah, so you're right. So but here, in this case, of course, this thing is equally probable as that thing. So it's just system randomly chooses whether it wants to be up or it wants to be down. So now if I have external magnetic field, well, this is forced on you. That, you know, this is really energetically favorable situation. If you swap the external field on the other side, it will be that one here. But now you don't choose really. So there's no spontaneous symmetry breaking here anymore, because the field chooses the configuration in some sense. I don't know if I answered your question. Probably we can talk about it a little bit later. So this is what happens with your M. So now let us expand this relation. Again, we still see that if B goes to zero, this thing will be relatively small. So M will be basically zero if B is zero. So you can still expand this relation here, treating M and B as small quantities. So now using the formula that tangents h of x is something like x minus x cubed over 3, you get that m approximately equals to mj plus b over t, and then minus 1 over 3 mj plus b over t cubed. Okay, so this is what we are getting from that relation there. And then, of course, we want to calculate this susceptibility, which is a derivative of M with respect to B. Okay, so that gives you that chi, which is dm over dB, well, it's this thing here, and it's approximately equal to, okay, so now dm over dB gives me chi, and j over t is still there, so chi j over t, and then dB over dB is just 1, so it's just plus 1 over t. So that's the first term. And if you look at the second term, it's exactly the same one, what's inside, but now I have to differentiate cube thing, so this is equal to 1 minus mj plus b over t square. And so now we are interested in this susceptibility at B equal to zero. And so I can plug here, in some sense, b equal to 0. So now this gives me, well, it's just this b disappears. So, yeah. OK, so that's how the susceptibility is calculated. So now you are interested in evaluating this susceptibility as you approach the critical point from below and from above TC. So if you have T bigger than TC, then looking here at B equal to 0, basically, you see that your M is equal to 0. So plug it in there, I'm just getting chi equals to chi J over T plus 1 over T, and that's it. So chi 1 minus, so J is now TC, that's what we denoted before, and is equal to 1 over T. So chi is 1 over T, 1 minus TC over T. Okay, which is T minus TC. So now you can express this, again, in terms of the small parameter T, which was T minus TC over TC. So you can divide by 1 over TC here, and the denominator as well, but it doesn't matter. So this you define to be a new critical exponent gamma, so it goes like T to minus gamma, and if you look at what this gamma has to be, is equal to 1. So from here, gamma goes to 1. So your susceptibility diverges as you approach the critical point from above by 1 over T. Okay. A similar calculation would be when you are T smaller than TC. So in that case, you know from here that, where is it? It's not here. Oh, it's over there. So M goes like square root of 3 to 1 minus T over TC. So M square goes like 3 times 1 minus T over TC. So M square goes like 3 times 1 minus T over TC. So now you take this expression, you plug it here for M. So you have M square here. And then you evaluate it again chi. It's a complicated formula. But in the end, you can solve it. It's a linear equation, probably 1 half minus TC over T. So this is what you should get. So you just take this, plug it here, and evaluate chi. And this is what you get. And then this should be equal to or proportional to T absolute value now to minus a different critical exponent gamma prime. And of course, what you read from here is that this gamma prime is equal to 1 as well. Okay, so this is a critical exponent gamma and gamma prime, depending on whether you are approaching the critical point from above or from below. So this is your picture for chi. And then you have T, and this is your TC. And so chi diverges from both sides. And it diverges like 1 over small t. Okay, so that's second critical exponent. Oh, now what do we need? We maybe. Okay. So now another critical exponent is how M behaves with B when you are exactly at T equal to T critical. So now the next critical exponent is how system responds to B exactly at TC. Okay, so now for that, you can look at this expression again. So now I take this expression, which is still valid, and then I take J, well, then I take T equal to T critical. So J is equal to T critical as well. So you have M on the left-hand side, but M on the right-hand side as well. They cancel. Okay, but well, this guy becomes B over TC. So you have, from that relation, you have 0 approximately to T B over TC, B over TC. And then the second term, well, J is T critical, T is T critical. So this gives you M plus B to cube minus 1/3. Plus B over T critical cube. So now you are interested in, so if B is small, of course B cube will be even smaller. So all you need to really know is the, so you can expand this, but all that matters is really the first term in M. So you are getting then that M cube goes basically like B, or M is equal to, and now 3B over TC to 1/3. So now this is a definition of a new critical exponent, B 1 over delta, and you read from here that delta equals to 3. So that's a critical exponent which is calculated exactly at critical temperature. And you are interested in how the order parameter reacts on the presence of magnetic field. So it's precisely basically this picture here. So you switch on the small magnetic field and how M develops there, exactly at T critical. So that's third critical exponent, delta. And finally, there is another one associated with the specific heat. Okay, so recall that the specific heat is dS over dT at constant V. And of course, this is easy to measure. So that's why people like this guy. So now, this thing, so S is the derivative of the free energy with respect to T. So now this is equal to up to a minus sign. So this is minus T and then d square F over dT square at constant V, just using that S is dF over dT. Or if you want a specific small CV, which you now define as CV over N, then it is just given by minus T d square small f over dt square at constant V. This is a specific heat, per lattice site. Okay, so now you are calculating this guy in the absence of external magnetic field, because, yeah, so you're interested in that. So for that, all you need to know is the free energy over here, or actually its expansion, which is still over there. So to calculate this guy, you are just using the formula for the free energy. But again, you are interested to calculate this quantity above the critical point or below the critical point. Okay, so your free energy is whatever is written over there. But now, if you are at T bigger than TC, well, that's your expression, but you know that the magnetization is equal to zero. So I have Taylor series in M. Of course, that gives you identically equal to zero. So F is equal to zero if you are at T bigger than TC. And so if you calculate CV, of course, it's also zero. So now, if you are below TC, then you take that formula for F. But you know that how M behaves. You know that M square is 3 times 1 minus TC over T. You plug it there. So what you find is that F is minus 3 over 4 TC, and then T minus TC square. So this is up, you know, using the formula, but you are plugging what M square is. Okay, so M square goes here. Okay, so now you can differentiate twice with respect to T, and you get a constant. So in this case, your CV is equal to 3 halves T over TC. So now you again define the critical exponents. Now critical exponents alpha is telling you how much the specific heat diverges at a critical point if you are going from above or from below. So you require this thing to be proportional to T to minus alpha prime, and this thing to be proportional to T to alpha minus alpha. So that's how you define the corresponding critical exponents. So of course, here you find that alpha is equal to zero. And here, this is finite. It doesn't diverge. So this is also alpha prime equal to zero. Okay. So this is what we have found by our calculation. And it's a prediction of the mean field theory. So now, in reality, this is not what usually happens. And the specific heat actually does diverge at a critical point. So I'll just plot a typical picture. So this is our CV, and this is T, and this is T critical. And so what we've shown that if you are above T critical, CV is identically equal to zero. And then we've shown that if you are at below T critical, then it's given here. So at T critical is 3 halves, basically. So there is a jump of the specific heat, as mean field theory predicts. Well, then it happens differently, but so here it's 3 halves. And so we predicted a finite jump of the specific heat. And that's a prediction of mean field theory. But the reality is different. So in reality, what you measure is that the CV diverges here, and the CV diverges here as well. So this is happens in experiments. And so really, CV diverges in true experiments, like 1 over T to some power alpha or alpha prime if you are going from here or if you are going from that direction. Okay? So that's basically, apart from other two, which we will discuss tomorrow, that's all the critical exponents you need to know. So we have critical exponent alpha, which governs the specific heat. Critical exponent beta, which tells you how the order parameter behaves. Critical exponent gamma, which we calculated for our susceptibility, which is like And then finally delta, which tells you if I apply some external field, how the other parameter reacts on that, if you are exactly at T critical.
You say those are the only parameters you need, so don't you only need two?
Very good. Exactly, it's absolutely correct. Wait a few lectures, and we will arrive into that. Yeah, but you're absolutely correct. Okay, so this is the mean field theory prediction for all these things. And remember, so alpha equals to 0 in the mean field, C doesn't diverge there. Beta equals to 1/2, gamma equals to 1, and delta equals to 3. That's a prediction of mean field theory.
A question. You said that this is the way the critical parameters are defined. So is this a strict definition? So I say that B is to the power of 1 over delta, for example, and not just delta or.
So the way I did it is the definition of delta.
Okay.
If you want.
Okay. So delta and it's not random. It's really fixed.
It's really fixed. So what you really observe is that they behave like a power law.
Yeah.
So if you take this small parameter t,
mm-hmm.
all these quantities will behave as t to some power.
Mm-hmm.
They usually diverge. So it's minus.
Mm-hmm.
Some power, but yeah, this is the exact definition for the Ising model. But for other models, it will be similar. So I will define beta, how my order parameter, no matter what it is,
mm-hmm.
how it behaves.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, more generally, you can extend these definitions to other systems.
Hey, how do we fix this problem? I mean, the theory is not consistent with the experiment.
Exactly. So it's not a correct theory. It's almost correct theory, but not exactly correct. And we will have to do a lot of work to fix this. And I'll show you one way how people are trying to fix that. But yeah. So mean field theory is not exact. We know that in one dimension it's completely screwed up. In three dimensions it's more or less fine, but still it gives wrong critical exponents, for example. And so you have to do some work. To fix that. So now historically, there was this beautiful theory which basically came from this observation that the free energy near the critical point can be written in this form. And that's Landau's theory. So let me just mention that. And it's really something great. So basically, mean field theory, you know, really predicts you correctly that there will be a phase transition. It gives you a lot of good things, but it doesn't give you exact critical exponents. It's wrong in 1D and so on. Okay, so let me just mention Landau's theory. And so let me not, so you will have it in the whole tutorial and your homework dealing with Landau's theory, so let me be very brief here. So, but basically, you know, it turns out that these predictions of the mean field theory are very robust, and you can start with a different system, different Hamiltonian or whatever, and you will find out that you end up with the same mean field theory description, basically, and with the same critical exponents. So mean field theory, so the idea is that mean field theory results are very robust. And what they really depend on is basically general symmetry considerations. So what you need to do to actually predict all these critical exponents here and phase transitions and everything is you just need to know what is the order parameter in your Hamiltonian, so what, you know, which, and what is the corresponding symmetry of the Hamiltonian? So only needs to know the order parameter and the corresponding symmetry. which gets broken in the phase transition. So in some sense, so we know in our case, M is this thing here. And we know that the original Hamiltonian over there had a discrete symmetry. If you change sigma I to minus sigma I, you got the same Hamiltonian. Okay? And the symmetry was that sigma I goes to minus sigma I. And of course, that implies that the free energy must satisfy the same symmetry. So the free energy of M must be the same as the free energy of minus M. Okay, so now we went through some painful procedure to basically derive that the free energy near the vicinity of the critical point behaves like something M square, something M to the 4. But Landau says, well, you could have saved your time. And you know, no matter what happens in between, I can always write down this F. Because I know that the order parameter is m, and I know that f of m must be f of minus m. So f cannot be linear in m or qubit in m. It would break that symmetry down. So it can be m square, m4, m6, and so on. Okay. So then basically Landau tells you I can immediately write down that f is something like one coefficient r m square plus another coefficient u m to the 4. So now your free energy, so you want to minimize your free energy. So that imposes the fact that, of course, for large m, if this were negative, then the global minimum would be for large m. You don't want that. So you want your free energy ultimately to go like this. So that tells you that u must be positive. You must be positive so that if I minimize my free energy, I have some minimum at finite m. Okay, so that's the thing. So this is true for stability, or if you want, for the fact that the global minimum of the free energy is at finite m. And finally, if you went through the derivation, we observe that coefficient r actually has to be proportional to small t. Okay, so that's another thing which you have to postulate. So you say, so another postulate here is that r is proportional to small t. So in other words, that r changes the sign as you cross the critical point. So you must have, you know, something. So these r and u can in principle depend on temperature, but this r must depend in such a way that it can change the sign. Okay, and that's it. So basically that was Landau's procedure. And as I said, you will study it today in your tutorial. But that's it. So basically given any microscopic model, you just look at the symmetries of that model, you identify what the order parameter is, and then you respect the symmetries of the model and you write down immediately what the free energy must look like. And once you have the free energy, you can calculate everything else from there. You can calculate all the critical exponents. You can predict everything. Okay. And so this was Landau's ingenious idea how to describe all phase transitions in 1 minute, basically. Okay. So we will study it more.
Sorry, what was the justification for the last buffer?
Well, okay. So in principle, this R and U, they depend on T. Right, so you, what you are doing here is like an expansion of f or, in terms of the order parameter. So you identify that your order parameter is m. So you'll have expansion Taylor series if you want in this parameter m. So now the only thing you have to respect the symmetry of the original Hamiltonian that gives you that. So that kills the terms linear in m and cubic in m and so on. But what stands here in principle can depend on the temperature. Right. So now if I take this thing to be a boring, nice function, then you are not really, well, it's a boring, nice function. you wouldn't get any criticality. So basically, you are asking, you may pose the problem, so what these things have to be so that I observe the corresponding phase transition? And so I was arguing here is that in order to see our phase transition, you have to have R proportional to T. This is something general, and you will derive that R must be proportional to T. But it's something like if you didn't, then if nothing happened with this R at T critical, you wouldn't see any phase transition. And so this thing wouldn't be good to describe a phase transition. So this is like an additional postulate, if you want. You can play with these expansion parameters or expansion coefficients so that you actually fit it to observe the bright phase transition. Yeah?
But this is only for New York symmetry breaking phase transitions, right? Where like the order parameters would be.
Sorry, it's for?
It's for mirror symmetry breaking, like whatever it is, like set to symmetry breaking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so if you have
that, is there some reason why that is like super pervasive? Like, is that all like?
So here I am. It's a very good question. So here I'm just demonstrating the Landau's theory on the simplest possible example of the Ising model and similar things, so set to symmetry breaking. But you can generalize this to other symmetry breakings, and you can make it more complicated. The Landau, so this guy is called Landau's functional, if you want, or Landau's free energy, and it will look more complicated for if you have other. But yes, you can describe various things by doing similar arguments as here. Yeah, but it's a good question. So now what is actually interesting is that this theory is in some sense very powerful, but it's maybe too powerful than to describe real nature. Okay, so let me just say that diverse systems in nature that may have nothing to do with each other. So you can have Ising model on one side, and you can have water and its transition from liquid to vapor on the other side. And so diverse systems in nature can have the same critical exponents, despite being very different. Okay, and so, for example, water and Ising model is the case. So if the critical exponents for the systems, and if there are phase transitions, and then you experimentally measure these critical exponents, and they agree, or you get the same set of critical exponents, then you have the same universality class. So same universality class means I have exactly the same critical exponents, all of them. Okay. So now we have seen that mean field theory in this approach sort of predicts all these critical exponents, and it predicts their exact values. In the way I used it, so apart from your thing that I can have more complicated symmetries of the Hamiltonian whatsoever, but for this symmetry, it basically predicts this one set of critical exponents. Okay, so mean field theory predicts basically one universality class, and that's given by this alpha equals to 0, beta equal to 1/2, gamma equal to 1, and delta equal to 3. So this was the prediction of the mean field theory, and it predicts one concrete universality class. Okay. So now the problem and the trouble is that this universality class, well, these critical exponents are almost never observed. So that was the question here, how to do better, how to actually fix these critical exponents so that they exactly correspond to what you measure. And for that, we need to do a lot of work, and we will do it hopefully this week. And so basically that leads to the field theory and leads to the randomization group. So that will be, for the rest of the week, we'll be doing that, basically trying to upgrade these critical exponents to something which is more realistic and corresponds more to the nature. So this is the prediction on mean field theory, but it's not a correct one. So now what you can say, at least experimentally, is that the true critical exponents, so this is the prediction, but it's not very good. So this prediction almost never observed. Never observed. But what is actually observed is that your critical exponents in real systems, they can depend on the dimensionality of system, so depend on D, which is the dimensionality of the system. The system, they can depend on the symmetries of your Hamiltonian, symmetry of Hamiltonian, and nature of the order parameter. So, in particular, and that was your question, maybe my order parameter is not just a scalar function, one magnetization, but it's a vector, or it's something more complicated. So whether this is, you know, M or M vector, or some other possibilities. So now if you look at these things here, well, this was precisely what Landau was telling you. So all I need to know is the symmetry of the Hamiltonian, and all I need to know is what the order parameter is. Now, the dimensionality, of course, mean field theory doesn't take into account, so we will have to do something more there. Okay, so that's what the critical exponents actually experimentally do depend on. And of course, you know, why the mean field theory breaks down is really it doesn't take these fluctuations properly into account. And so that was crucial in one dimension, but it's also true in higher dimensions, unless you are d equal to 4. And so the reason why mean field theory breaks, of course, is the fluctuations. But also, it treats the order parameter as constant. So our M here was just something constant in our Hamiltonian, and that was the problem. So in order to take the fluctuations into account, you need to actually replace this treatment of the order parameter as a constant. You want to treat it as a thermodynamic variable. Something that can change from place to place and, you know, fluctuate and can fluctuate. Okay, so that's basically the goal to do now. So this is the reason why the mean field theory is not exact, why it breaks down. And this is what you have to do in order to make it better. Okay, so this is still, I want to keep this one. Questions?
Okay.
So mean field theory is a good theory. You should always start, you know, solving your problem using mean field theory. But of course, you don't get, it's a cheap solution if you want, but it's not completely exact solution you get through mean field theory. Okay, so now let's see what we need to do to actually go beyond this. And it's really painful, but well, it's usually improving your result slightly takes long time. Okay, so part C, and it will be from Ising model, from Ising to field theory. And so the idea, so this is our Hamiltonian for the Ising model, and we want to calculate the corresponding partition function. We calculate it in the mean field theory approximation. So now let us not do any approximations, and let's just write a new formula for this partition function. So what we really want to calculate is the set for the Ising model, which is of course sum over sigma I, and then e to minus beta h, so it's minus, so it's plus over 2t, and then sum over I and j, and jij sigma I, sigma j. So this is what you want to calculate. And then the trick is to use an expression for the Gaussian integral. And this expression for the Gaussian integral has a very nice name. It's called Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation. Okay, so now use the Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation. Which is nothing else than the Gaussian integral, basically. So it's a generalization of the fact that if you have an integral 1 over 2 pi, integral from minus infinity to infinity, d phi, e to minus 1 half, a phi square, plus gamma phi. So if you take this integral here, that is given by 1 over square root of a, and then e to gamma square over 2a. And this is for a bigger than 0, so that the integral is well defined. So that's your Gaussian integral. Now you can make a multidimensional Gaussian integral. So okay, let's do it. It's pain, but let's do it. So if you have n dimensions, so then you have 2 pi to n over 2, and then minus infinity to infinity, d phi 1 to d phi n, and then this guy gets minus 1 half, and then your parameter A becomes a matrix, so we'll have phi I, aij, phi j. Phi I, aij, phi j, and then plus gamma I, phi I. So that's your generalization of your Gaussian integral into a multidimensional one. And this is given by square root of, so A now becomes a determinant of that matrix aij, 1 over the determinant A, and then e to 1 half gamma I, and then aij to minus 1 gamma j. Okay. So it looks that it could be a multidimensional generalization of Gaussian integral. So now we want to apply this formula. Namely, you want to use this thing here, which is already in your partition function, and write it in terms of this horrible thing or horrible mass on the left-hand side. Okay, so (clears throat) just trying to find if there is a mistake in the notes. Maybe we shall see. So anyway, so we want to use this guy here. And in order to use that guy there, we will say, well, okay. Let me call this to be Aij, okay? Not Aij to minus one, but Aij. So then you will get Aij minus one over there. And the determinant of the inverse metric matrix is one over the determinant of the matrix. Okay, so using this thing here, but calling this thing Aij to minus one, you will now be calling that this thing here, Jij. And then you will be using gamma I is sigma I. So this is your transcription, how to go from that thing to what we need to use here. Okay, so what is this equal to? So if you do that, so you still have the sum over all sigma I. And then I am using the right-hand side, expanding in terms of the left-hand side. So that will be, okay, so now there are some t's.
Yeah, David, there's a mistake in 235 in the notes. It should be determinant of A. It should be on the top.
Yeah, there's definitely a mistake in 235, but I think that's okay because you are using a determinant of the inverse matrix now. So inverse determinant of the inverse matrix is one over determinant of the matrix.
But then you also have to make A minus.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So anyway, the result I think is fine. So let me just write it down and then you will do it yourself. T to n half and then determinant of J square root of that and then one over two pi n half. So that basically comes from here and from this determinant here. And then this multidimensional integral from minus infinity to infinity. And let me not write d phi 1 to d phi n, but let's just write d phi vector. And then e to minus t half phi I j I j minus 1. Phi j, and then plus sigma I phi I. Okay? So hopefully this one is correct. So let's hope. I was doing jij over t is aij minus 1. Aij over t is aij minus 1, hopefully. OK. Do it yourself. You will see whether that works or not. If it doesn't, then you'll have to correct the notes. OK. So now you can still play with these things. And you can actually send phi I to phi I over t. Okay, so for that, if you do that, then we'll actually just mess with these things here, and it will kill some of these t's sitting in front of the integral. So hopefully that gives you 1 over determinant of j, square root of that, and then 1 over 2 pi t to n half, and then sum over the spins is still there, and the integral d phi, and then e minus 1 over 2 t phi I j I j minus 1 phi j, and then sigma I phi I, and it's probably over t. Okay, so far, this is just, you know, mathematics. You are not doing anything wrong with this. You are just taking the partition function for your Ising model, and you are using some mathematical identity. You are using the Gaussian integral identity here. And so this is still exact expression for your partition function. We haven't done any approximations here. Okay. So now we will still have everything exact, but we'll be just interested in really describing the phase transition. So you know that to describe the phase transition, you need to extract a non-analytic part of your partition function and free energy. Okay, so everything that is analytic has nothing to do with the phase transition. Okay, so in particular, this t pi t and half, okay, that's an analytic function of t. Okay, so what you will do is basically you say, well, it's an analytic function, it's some prefactor standing in front of my z, I don't care what it is. Okay, let's throw it away. In other words, let's set it equal to 1. Or if you want, you can absorb it into the measure of d phi. That's an alternative possibility, but it doesn't matter. So, so you will not need that factor anymore. So concentrating on the non-analytic part of, possible non-analytic part of your partition function, we throw the prefactor away. And you find that your z is equal to the same thing with determinant of j. It's equal to sum over sigma I. And then, yeah, you may want to remember that that prefactor was there, but not really, you don't need it. So I'm writing now d phi instead of small d phi. And you know that, that has that factor in it. It's minus 1 over 2 t phi I jij minus 1 phi j, and then plus sigma I phi I over t. So far, this is still exact.
And the capital D in the differential just means that you've absorbed the factor?
Yeah, if you want, or set it equal to 1.
Okay.
Yeah, the same thing for us. Okay, so now this is the expression, but now look at this beauty. So if you look at, you know, so we still have to do this trace over all possible spins. So all these sums over sigma I. But now if you look at, the only appearance of sigma I is over here. So it's actually a linear term. So it's exponential of sigma I times something. And you can do this sum because it's just a sum of, you know, exponentials. So using the fact that if you have that sum over, for example, sigma I, well, sigma 1, or doesn't matter, e to 1 over t phi I sigma I, so you get sums like that. And so for all possible I, but of course, this is just the exponential of plus exponential of minus the exponent, and that gives you the logarithm, well, it gives you the cosine h, which you can write as exponential of logarithm of cosine h. So e to logarithm of 2 times cosine h of phi I over t. So cosine h and the logarithm is here. Okay. Yes.
Are we working with finite lattices or infinite ones?
Sorry?
Are we working with finite or infinite lattices?
Why do you ask? You just want to know.
I just want to know whether that's an extra assumption or not.
Well, at this point, yeah.
I mean, yeah, you are swapping an integral with an infinite sum, so I just.
Yeah. At this point, everything is finite, but yeah, sure. So anyway, so we can do these sums. So we can actually kill these terms in terms of this e to logarithm of that thing here. And so you arrive at a beautiful expression, which is equal to z, is an integral of d phi e to minus the action of phi, where the action of phi is just 1 over 2 t phi I jij minus 1 phi j, and then minus sum over I logarithm 2 cosine h phi I over t. Okay, so you have rewritten, and this is still exact, so you have rewritten your problem for your partition function as a functional integral that you have seen probably in the field theory by now. So now we have a functional integral over field phi here of some minus e to minus some action, and this action is given here. And it's an exact result. Okay, so we basically turned the problem of spins and lattices almost into field theory. Well, this is still not true, because if you look at these things, so if you treat this phi as a field, and it still has the index I, it means it's still only defined on the lattice points of your lattice. So it's still a discrete field. It's still not a continuum field. So in order to get the full field theory, which we will do tomorrow, we need to take a continuum limit of this. So we will be taking limit of n goes to infinity, Nick, and taking the limit of the real field theory tomorrow. So then you will go with n to infinity tomorrow. But at this point here, this is still, you know, a field which is defined only in the lattice points. Okay. So that's that. How much time I have? I still have 5 minutes. That's perfect. So now let me tell you what this field might actually describe. And so, any guesses for how this field is, the field phi I can be related to something you already know from, you know, this, we said we need to promote the order parameter, which was a constant, to something which is now allowed to fluctuate. Of course, this field is allowed to fluctuate, right? So this phi has to play some a role of some generalization of M. Okay, so let me show that. So of course, given the functional integral, the first thing you want to know is what is the mean, what is the WKB approximation of this thing, or what is the settle point approximation, right? And that tells you something about the system. So let's look at the settle point approximation. Means you are basically taking a minimum of this functional and you're expressing the whole thing as an e to s, minimizing this thing here. Okay, so for that, so let phi 1 bar equals to phi 2 bar equals to phi n bar be the configuration. Okay. They are equal because the lattice size, all the lattice points are equal. But let's do it this way first. Configuration that minimizes S. Okay, so for that, you know that ds over d phi I evaluated at these phi 1 bar and so on must be equal to 0. So that's a thing which you have to minimize. Okay, so now I'm taking a derivative with respect to phi I. So I'm just killing this phi I here. And I have to take a different derivative of this thing here. So you get this is equal to 1 over t, so there's two of them, and then there's still sum over j, jij minus 1, and then phi j as the first term, and the second term is just derivative logarithm, it gives you cosine at the bottom, and then sine, so tangens h phi I over t. Okay, so this is your equation, or if you rearrange the terms, so you multiply by Jij inverse of this thing, and then you use the fact that sum over Jij as before is just J. This is what we used before. So now you can find out that phi I bar is just J times tangens H, and then phi I over t. Now, it doesn't matter where you are in the lattice. Phi 1 must be the same thing, average thing as phi 2 and so on. So from here, this is your expression. Okay. So now you want to compare this to what you know in your mean field theory. And I probably deleted that, but it was an expression m equals to tangens h mj over t. So now you want to compare that thing with this thing. And you see that if you take m, well, if you take phi bar to be mj, then you recover your mean field theory. Gives mean field theory. So really, what we have managed to do is that we have written the partition function in terms of some fields. These fields can fluctuate. They are defined on the lattice point, but they can fluctuate now. But if you take the saddle point approximation, you take them to be average thing, which is independent of, you know, where you are in the lattice, so they are the same, then you get back your mean field theory. So this description through phi is probably much better, because now we don't have to do the saddle point approximation. You can go beyond it, and you can capture all the fluctuations of these things. So we'll continue here tomorrow.